This is the time. This is the place. Here and now, the mystery awaits to break into our experience, to change our minds, to change our lives, to help us see the world and the whole of life in a new light. This is the place. This is the time. Here and now, let us praise the mystery by joining together in song. And now, at the center of our service, at the center of our lives, we take this time to light candles of memory, candles of hope, candles of renewal, or because we feel troubled, blessed, conflicted, or simply because we'd like to add a little light to the world. Would you join me, please, in an attitude of prayer? Mystery of many names, mystery beyond all naming. We're here today in our herky-jerky manner. We've raced here to find peace and tranquility. We're caught up in our contradictory thoughts that scold us worse than any parent ever could have. We are, in truth, our own worst taskmasters. What can we do about it? It's time to realize that we're not alone in this business of having a life that seems ordered on the outside, but on the inside is a web of tangled skeins. Trying to separate the threads of the skein internally only pulls the knots tighter, and we long for release from this mind that will not let us go. It's time to start to show the cracks in our lives. Time to let others in on our big secret, which once we do it, we find out it's their big secret too. We're lost and lonely, and there isn't a prayer in the world that can change that. But we do have each other. Help us to realize that which separates us from our neighbor is our inability to simply open up and let out our secrets. We are individuals, that's true. But defining ourselves takes community. And the only way to define yourself inside community is to share with others what's on your mind. You might be surprised. It may very well be that collectively we hold things that we are not proud of, and yet we are not alone in this shame. There's an old Jewish tradition in synagogues. One person stands up and tells a bad story about themselves, and then another stands and tries to top that bad story by a worse one. The winner is the congregate who can tell the most horrible story about themselves that no one else can top. What a turning of the tables that would be for us all, to admit our foibles and be rewarded for them. May we have the strength today to admit that we are human, not perfect, a marble cake of contradictory feelings and may this admission be greeted with the loosening of others as they decide to leave the conspiracy of silence and let it all hang out. In a popular song, we are reminded that there is a crack in everything, and that's how the light gets in. Let's open up and let in the light of love and friendship. Let's embody our humanity and be proud of it. We pray this in the name of everything that is holy, and that is precisely everything. Amen.
One's from Blaise Pascal, and the other's from Chris Christopherson. And amazingly, they're saying the same thing.
First, Pascal, what a chimera man is, what a novelty, what a monster, what a chaos, what a contradiction, what a prodigy. Judge of all things, imbecile worm of the earth, depository of truth, a sink of uncertainty and error, the pride and refuge of the universe. These foundations solidly established make us know that there are two truths of faith equally certain. the one that man in the state of creation or in that of grace is raised above all nature, made like unto God and sharing in God's divinity. The other that in the state of corruption and sin, he has fallen from this state and made like unto the beasts. Hear those same thoughts with Mr. Christopherson's twist. It's a song from the early 70s. The album is The Pilgrim. And the song is chapter 33. He's a poet. He's a picker. He's a prophet. He's a pusher. He's a pilgrim and a preacher and a problem when he's stoned. He's a walking contradiction, partly truth, partly fiction, taking every wrong direction on his lonely way back home. There was a professor at the University of Florida when I attended there from 1965 to 1969 by the name of Sidney Gerard. He was in the psychology department. The first book that I wrote that Sidney wrote was entitled Disclosing Man to Himself. It's a study of self-disclosure and how telling others about ourselves not only informs them who we are, but also keeps authentic the notion that there is something about us that is real, and perhaps the best way to find out what that is in dialogue with another human being. Also at the University of Florida in 1965 was Dr. Thomas Lewis Hanna, head of the philosophy department, a graduate of Texas Christian University, where he played football and was also a collegiate middleweight boxing champ in the late 40s. He graduated from TCU with a BA in philosophy and a minor in music, and then he went on to the University of Chicago, where he got his Bachelor's of Divinity, and like Dr. Lohr, he earned his PhD in philosophy. I first met Dr. Hanna in Hume Hall, the dormitory I lived on my freshman year. I saw a poster on the bulletin board that said that Dr. Hanna, head of the philosophy department at the university, would be talking that night in the rec room on the Playboy philosophy. Well, I was certainly interested in that. I wandered down to the rec room thinking that there would be a few people scattered about, but it was standing room only, and I was one of the ones standing. Dr. Hanna went on to explain to his audience, who were, if not subscribers to Playboy magazine, certainly borrowers of that same magazine, what he saw to be the implications of the Playboy philosophy. We were all anxious to hear about this because we all wanted to be the BMOC. You remember what that was? The big man on campus. Yeah. Now, we knew the big man on campus. He wore the cool clothes, and he drove a really fast car, and he knew everything that there was to know about women. And we suspected that an explanation of the Playboy philosophy would give us geeky freshmen, pardon the pun, a leg up on how to woo the girls and get them where we wanted them. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. Dr. Hanna was smooth. He explained the Playboy philosophy from Hugh Hefner's viewpoint, and really I can't remember a single thing about what he said about that. But then he went on to do a critique of that same philosophy, and that critique I shall never forget. He, in fact, wasn't saying anything bad about masturbation, but he was saying that a magazine whose literary merits were sublimated by the pictures of young co-eds, or at least young women old enough to be co-eds, whether they were or not, a magazine of that type lent itself chiefly to the masturbatory process. And the final question, we've all been there. I won't say the second part of that. And the final question he asked all these very young men was, what kind of relationship and philosophy can you expect to have with and toward women when the majority of your time is spent with a magazine, practicing sex with an airbrush symbol, totally removed from any personal interaction, and hermetically sealed from the sights, sounds, and smells of a real woman? We may have been freshmen, but we understood the import of that rhetorical question. And furthermore, we understood the implications of a philosophy so implicated. More interesting to me than the Playboy philosophy was how Dr. Hanna had played a bait and switch with us. We'd expected to learn how to be the BMOC. But what we'd really learned was that such a person was a hollow man, a straw man, whose attitude toward women was based upon only one of the attributes of femininity, and lacking any real basis in the world. Now, what does this have to do with the corruption of grace and the grace of corruption? Perhaps you can see the parallels already with Williams' play, perhaps not. There is a connection. As we go along, it become clear, I hope. I remember very clearly one afternoon in summer when I was living in Murphy Hall, another dormitory. I walked out of the dorm and there were some handball courts along University Avenue in Gainesville, Florida. And Dr. Hannah and Dr. Gerard were out there shirtless playing handball. These two older men playing handball at a speed which I would be afraid to play handball at. I didn't stay to see who won, but I could tell you they played really hard. They could have played against much younger men. The image of these two men playing handball, sweating like they did, is very poignant for me because both of these men are now dead. Dr. Sidney Gerard was working on his sports car one afternoon in his garage, and the jack he was using collapsed and the sports car crushed his head. Dr. Thomas L. Hanna, at the age of 62, with the physical reflexes of a man in his 30s, swerved to miss, it is conjectured, since no one saw the one car accident, a cat, a dog, a squirrel, or some other sentient being, left the roadway and collided with a telephone pole. 2 years before Dr. Hanna's death, when he was 60 years old, he realized he had to tell everything he knew about our bodies and their inherent dignity and grace. He had to tell the world at large. He and Sidney were buddies, and Tom knew that not to disclose fully everything that he learned about himself and his body would be, in essence, hiding from his fellow human beings and ultimately hiding from himself. The point is, most people are taught to hide their true feelings. And even underneath that, the point is, most people don't even know what their true feelings are. When I first went to AA, someone asked me how I felt. Well, it was summer, and I knew that outside I felt hot, and inside, where the air conditioning was, I felt cool. But other than that, I didn't have a clue. In polite society, it's not considered kosher to be frank. It's not considered a part of everyone getting along to disclose that you do not agree with the dominant cultural position, no matter what the issue is. It doesn't take a great deal of imagination to see that this same sort of suppression, this kind of domination is at work today when it comes to the war in Iraq, proper treatment of prisoners of war, the growing gap between the rich and poor, the erosion of our democratic processes, global warming. The list goes on and on. In some circles, it is still considered unpatriotic to voice an opinion contrary to the present regime. Shifting back in time, 1799. That was the year Friedrich Schleiermacher, who was called the father of liberalism, published his first work. Schleiermacher maintained that religion was not a form of knowledge, as the rationalists and the orthodox believed, nor was it a system of morality, as Immanuel Kant put forth. But for Schleiermacher, religion, not based in pure or practical reason, but was based in Gefühl, which is a bad pronunciation, I'm sure, of the German word, which means feeling. This is not sentimentalism. It's not sudden conversion experiences, but a profound experience of our dependence upon the one on which all existence depends. In other words, our absolute dependence upon God, or if you'd prefer, the ground of being. The purpose of the church for Schleiermacher is to relate these absolute feelings of dependency within the church and future generation. In other words, the emphasis is on sharing these feelings with one another, disclosure. These feelings of dependency occur on three levels: the self its relations to the world, and the self's relation to the ground of being. For Schleiermacher, anything that does not deal with these three feelings simply isn't theology. For theology to deal with the feelings of the self, its relation to the world, and its ground of being is as close to existentialism as you'll get without using the word. And the kind of philosophy that Dr. Hanna taught and the kind of psychology that Dr. Gerard practiced both were existential in nature. Existentialism is concerned with the feelings that one has within one's body, feelings of grandeur, feelings of passion, anxiety, despair, all heavy internal emotional states. Within the world of theology, I come down with the existentialist and Schleiermacher. You might even say that I get down with them. Religion is about my relationships with myself, my relationships with the world, and my relationship with the ground of my being. Most of us come from religious traditions, unfortunately, that claim we were born into sin. That is, we were raised within an environment that saw human life as tainted from the word go. Obviously, this is a negative way of looking at life and is basically pessimistic. Buddhists do not believe in the notion of original sin, and their quests through meditation and sutra readings are bent on the direction of rediscovering their original face before they were born. In other words, finding out what the world and they looked like before they were told what the world looked like and what they were supposed to look like. In his work, Sidney Gerard was stressing that if we successfully hide from others, which is something men do much better than women, we will end up hiding from ourselves, and there will come a time in which we do not know who we are simply because we have not shared who we are with others. We are individuals, true, but we must define ourselves within community. In the vein of liberal religion via Schleiermacher, our first responsibility is our responsibility to ourselves. If we are to have adequate relations with the world, with other people, and eventually with the ground of our being, then we better be in communication with who we are. Who are we? Quite simply, I am this body. You are those bodies. We live our lives within the framework of this physical entity, and we receive impressions of what the world is like from both outside our skins and from within. Not to honor the communication that we receive from within is to short-circuit our understanding of who we are and our place in the world. Thich Nhat Hanh said that world peace begins in the human heart, and when there is peace in the human heart, it grows from there. In like manner, if we are to be autonomous and free individuals who make responsible decisions about who we are and how we are to operate in this world, then we must honor the first relationship, the relationship we have with ourselves. Jesus said, and he was only quoting older Jewish scripture, you must love your neighbor as yourself. But if there is no love of self, there can be no love of neighbor. We can no longer speak of a mind-body split. Dr. Hanna retooled a Greek word to stand for both the body and the mind because he saw no separation between them. He called human beings somas. The Greek word soma, S-O-M-A, is used in science and medicine to refer to a cell body, but Dr. Hanna's contemporary definition sees all of us as much more than simply bodies acted upon by outside forces. We are at one and the same time somatic beings that have internal perceptions about the world and ourselves, and we are capable of controlling how we function in this world. But how do we regain control in a world which seems to be spinning out of control? First thing we have to do is take control of our bodies. In Dr. Hanna's terms, 85% of industrial populations of the world suffer from SMA, sensory motor amnesia. That is, we have lost contact with our bodies and forgotten how certain large muscle groups are supposed to feel when they're relaxed. So sensory motor amnesia describes the effects of a lifetime of daily stresses upon our bodies. There's basically two disorders can demonstrate sensory motor amnesia, and I'm going to demonstrate both. The first is the red light reflex. It's best demonstrated when someone fires a gun and behind you and you didn't even know they had a gun, and it looks like this. Now, there's nothing wrong with this reflex. It saved many a soldier's life. What's wrong is when these responses are continually involved in our daily stressful lives. Worry brings the shoulders up because it's part of the same withdrawal response. In fact, here's a little experiment you can do at home. It's impossible to say, oye vey, without bringing your shoulders up. The second is the green light reflex. It's very prevalent in industrialized society. It's that get up and go quality that typifies North American consciousness, and it looks like this. You get the green light and the red light. The green light and the red light. It's like a Martha Graham dance. Then, in older people, you get both of them together. Are you ready? You get the red light and the green light. And it's not funny, and it doesn't have to be that way. If we are to typify these two responses, the red and the green light responses, we have to say that while the red light response is negative distress, the green light response is positive response. This response is awakened in us when we are just babies. The ability of a baby to finally hold up its head, to flex its legs out at the age of 6 months, and finally with its head lifted and straightening out its knees, the child begins to crawl. That's the culmination and full discovery of the green light response. But what happens in an industrialized world when we're perpetually in a green light reflex? What happens if the stimulus for the green light reflex is constant in our society? Continual repetition guarantees that the reflex will be constant, habitual, and eventually unnoticed by us. When this happens, we are in sensory motor amnesia. And how do we feel? After a day of go, 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 we feel tired, sore, and worn out. After a lifetime of stress, we feel sick and tired and ready to die. I showed you what it looks like when both of these responses are together, and it doesn't have to be that way. Again, what does this have to do with the corruption of grace and the grace of corruption? How does this talk of bodies and green and red light responses inform any discussion about whether we are like unto the gods or bestial? It's very simple, really. Life is a marble cake. You ever notice that? It's never all chocolate or all vanilla. It's a swirl of this, blending of that. Those who wish to see life as black or white or right or wrong are disappointed when confronted with this swirling inconsistency. In order to maintain a philosophy of life that does not admit the marble cakeness of life, children are taught not to touch themselves, that they do not feel what they feel. Women are told they are not equal to men. Men are taught that boys don't cry. Older people are taught that they are misshapen because that's what old age looks like. Lies, lies, every one of them lies. It's time to stop trying to get our bodies to fit inside philosophies and theologies that are anti-life. It's time for the body to assert itself and to say what it feels and how what it feels translates into relationship and community. It's time for embodied spirituality. Let's face it. We are many things that do not go together. We're poets. We're pickers. We're prophets. We're pushers. We're pilgrims and preachers and problems when we're stoned. We're walking contradictions, partly truth and partly fiction, making every wrong direction on our lonely way back home. I honestly feel like my mentor, Dr. Hanna, that I too will die before long. Let's face it, if I live another 30 years, I'll be 89 years old, and what's the chances of that? I do not wish to leave this world or this congregation before I give to you everything I know about how to be a non-anxious presence in your body and in this world. In an effort to do just that, this sermon has been and is a preamble to a course that I'll be offering in adult religious education this fall. This sermon is the spiel of a snake oil salesman. This course will begin on September the 2nd, Saturday from 9 to 11. That's next Saturday. Continue every Saturday for 6 weeks, ending on Saturday, October the 7th. Those who wish to explore the idea that they may be suffering from sensory motor amnesia are more than welcome to attend. What I can promise you is this. Even if you do the movements poorly, don't practice them every day, don't read the book, but come to class for those 6 weeks, you will still see a noted difference in how you feel and how you get along in this world. Every good sermon has a prescription for its congregation. This one is not a written one. It's just come to class. Buy the book. If you buy it from me, you can get it for $16.52. Do the movement suggested. Learn to live free inside your own skin. Freedom, independence, autonomy. These qualities are what human life is all about. Who among us could not use a means of becoming more self-responsible? And if the fascist heel comes down in this country, guess what? You can still be free inside your own body. At the end of this service, as a matter of fact, she's standing back there right now. An usher will have a clipboard in the foyer. I'm telling you, this is a spiel of a snake oil salesman. Please stop. Sign up. Together we can learn to be free and self-regulating human beings. And caution, there's a limit of 20 people in the class because the classroom I got only fits 20 people laying down. Now, there's something about birds and worms that comes into play right here. The first service used 15 of those 20 places. But there are 5 places left and 5 places for the waiting list because you know somebody's going to go, my body? And they're going to cancel. So, and I'll probably be offering it anyway. This is one of those things that one person's going to learn and somebody else is going to learn and they're going to teach somebody else. Dr. Hanna saw over 3,000 patients in his lifetime and he never saw those people again after he taught them what to do. He saw men who, with dowager's humps, who could not lay down in the bed on their back and breathe. And after about 3 weeks, they were laying down comfortably and breathing fully. He taught them the necessary information so he didn't have to come back. He taught them that the sensory motor system is a closed loop in the cerebral cortex and that by daily minimal movements, take no more than 10 minutes, we can retrain the brain to reorganize and recognize what the relaxed state of our muscles feel like. What's the relationship between corruption and grace and corruption? Redemption comes not through ascending to the gods, but by descending into our bodies, being totally present and taking back control on the physical level. That's my definition of grace. God, enlightenment, health do not reside outside our bodies, but within. Come join me in the journey to the center of ourselves. The true relationship between corruption and grace is like a Texan standing in his pasture. Why, his boots may be in the cow manure, his hat is in the stars. We are that consciousness that spans this great divide, the fallen state of humankind, the bestial, the bestial, and the raised state made like unto God are but the warp and woof of life's material. But as it passes through our hands, as it passes through our body, surely we feel the difference, yet know it to be of one skein. Remember the ending I give every prayer at this church. In the name of everything, it is holy, and that is precisely everything. Amen.